Welcome to Value Through Vulnerability. This is a podcast dedicated to putting the human back into humanity, and I'm your host, Gary Turner. I'm also the founder of Hexo Change, and Hexo Change is a transformational change practice dedicated to helping you connect to yourself, to others, and to systems at large in a more meaningful way, thus helping us turn around our workplace and planetary challenges and accelerating how alive we all feel in every aspect of our lives. This track is called Kaleidoscope and was created for me personally and for Hexo Change by Peter Griffiths, one half of the amazing Mind Takeaway. I hope you enjoy this exploration and please do share it on your social platforms so we can bring more humanity to more people. Hope to speak to you soon.
Okay. Hi, Gary. Good to see you today.
Likewise, Brooke. How are you?
Good, good. I see that you're in a beautiful place. You were able to get out of the house and go in front of what? The waterfalls?
the beauty of a Zoom background, Brooke.
Yeah, I know. Well, I can't even manage to do that. So my background is my dog pictures, my door, whatever. So anyways, but first of all, thank you for being here. And I wanted to have this conversation with you for a long time, but I felt like it's going to be very selfish if I'm the only one to hear your story out. So I thought a lot of people can get a lot out of your story because in my opinion, and we're going to go into more details, obviously, but the reason I wanted to talk to you today is that you are in a unique place from in my circles. Mm-hmm. In my circles, I usually have people like me who are solopreneurs, small businesses, who are trying to help the leaders out there to have more human first cultures. Because we know it's not only about the wording and that doesn't feel good. It just makes a huge difference for companies, even with their bottom line. So you are one of the unique people that I got to meet probably more than a year ago online. And then offline in May of 2019, which has a lot of good things to teach us because you have gone through a lot of good steps in where you work. Correct?
That is correct. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I want to hear all about that. We never had the chance to talk about this, although we have these great conversations. And I thought we're going to definitely share this with others because they have a lot to learn from you. And usually you are the one to ask a lot of questions to others and you highlight their stories, their messages. Now it's your turn, it seems. Okay.
Very kind of you, Brooke. Okay. Really looking forward to it.
Sure. So first of all, these are really my basic questions. I didn't prepare for this. I didn't want to do anything specific because people are going to listen in. But first, can you start with like every time I see Gary Turner, wherever I go, I also see the two words behind it, which says interpersonal catalyst. So can you tell us like about what that means to you, where it came from?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking the question, Brooke. So it's quite a recent evolution. And I'd love to get your expertise around purpose, actually, because what I would say is the clarification for me that my role on this planet is to be an interpersonal catalyst for other human beings. Mm-hmm. So what that means is I have quite a gift for, and we'll explore that today, bringing together the cultural aspects of an organization with the hard side of a business around developing sales teams, hitting the numbers, hitting the metrics. And I bring both of those worlds together really neatly as an interpersonal catalyst. So what that means is I run workshops, I do some coaching, run some live events, and it's all around creating the safe space that allows people to come in without the armor on, without their job title, without their history, and allow them to come into an environment that I help co-create with them, that allows them to innovate, to ideate, to challenge one another safely, and really just operate on a human level. And it's incredible some of the value that we've seen come out of those sessions, Brooke. And I do that both within my day job, and I also do it outside of my day job. It's really a combination, but I am first and foremost, I'm an international product manager working for my company. Yeah. But outside of that, in my own time, I'm also running workshops for other organizations as well.
Yeah, I can't keep up with what you do. I can't tell. Like, I always tell Gary, those of you who are listening, I say, like, and he is in UK, by the way, for those who don't know, I feel like wherever he lives, there's more than 24 hours a day because he does so much, and I'm always in awe with what he does. So when you watch him, you feel like you're not doing anything. So anyways, that's another story. But I do understand, like, having known you for a while now, that interpersonal catalyst is what I see in you. So however you came up with those words seems so real, and obviously it resonates with you, but also it just aligns with what we see, like, from the outside. When we look at Gary and what you do, whatever you do, your daily job, what you do besides your daily job, you are really connecting a lot of us in the most precious ways possible. So obviously you live what you say, and what you think who you are definitely resonates with all of us too. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Brooke. And I'd like to ask you a question, if I may, because I think purpose, of which you do a lot of work, mm-hmm. I would say that interpersonal catalyst for me, that I call it, if you look at my LinkedIn profile or Twitter, I call that catalyzing human connection for the betterment of everybody, like, inclusively. Yes. And I think I'm as close as I've ever been to what my purpose is. Mm-hmm. But what I found, I'd love your thoughts on this, Brooke, is mm-hmm. it's not a case that I've been striving to find my yes. purpose. It's almost been like I've been taking away the layers of an onion to uncover my purpose that already sits within me. So, but what's your thoughts on that?
That's a really good question. And I had very mixed, different feelings as I went through my purpose journey, just not my own journey, but the journey that I took with my clients who are trying to figure out what the purpose is. So I'm trying to be very mindful of what I use. Do you discover your purpose because it's already there? Or do you find it over time, both because what happens to you in your life? Or is it always the same, or does it evolve? I don't have concrete answers because I've seen it all. And I just, so funny that you mentioned that, because just yesterday I was tagged by you or Nuria, I think, tagged me on Simon Sinek's, like, one of his videos, just I think he posted yesterday. And it says, like, your purpose is the same throughout your life. And that's what I used to thought at the very beginning. But then I saw many people changing their purpose, especially when they went through some very difficult times. Like, you would probably have heard years ago, we had the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting. So parents have lost their really young children. And I saw them there, like, some of their lives have shifted tremendously, to start and work on having a whole new purpose, in my opinion at least, to go and stop this craziness about gun violence and make sure that no more kids are lost for something like this. And it, to me, it seemed like they changed their whole purpose in life. But do I know what their purpose in life was before that happened? No. But I had many different examples of this, that people, because of what happened to them, changed, like, what they are doing. Like, I had a friend whose second child became, when she was born, she had cerebral palsy. She was doing lots of different things, but now she's learning what that disease is. She's helping not only her own daughter, but others in this. So to me, it feels like, yes, we might have some thing to discover that's already there that makes up who we are, and we want to make sure we're aligned with it no matter what we do. But I also still believe, and we had that discussion today even on the same thread, if that is really coincidence that these people go through this tremendous thing, so that it's now even more obvious to them what they should do with their lives, or is it a coincidence or not? I don't know the answer to that, but I know for sure that we come here, it's the small little planet, and there's so many of us in there. When you look at the whole galaxy, it's like, it's the smallest thing, and we come here for a short amount of time. We create the meaning, and it is what we say it is. Nobody can tell us what our purpose is. So we create the meaning in that short time of what we're gonna do, instead of just sitting down and reacting to what happens to us. At least That's what I believe. I'm very long answer to a question, but it's so right here fresh because I just had that discussion on LinkedIn, actually. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, but it's what you say is resonating with who you are, so I understand that. So my second question, because that's how probably I met you through your podcast, I wanted to also ask you, all this time that I've known you, how did the podcast came about and why did you name it Value Through Vulnerability? What is value and vulnerability, those two big words, mean to you?
Thank you very much for the question. I've never been asked that question, Brooke. So that's really, really powerful. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So first of all, the reason that the podcast came into being in May 2018 was because at that time, and it's interesting you speaking about discovering or uncovering purpose, mm-hmm. because, you know, I spoke quite vocally and you're aware that I was bullied as a young person, you know, burnt myself out. And even more recently, I've had, you know, a cancer diagnosis. So like we've all got a journey. And I actually think part my journey back in May 2018, I'd been on part of what I would call a bit of an awakening journey for me personally as Gary. And what that means is waking up to the fact that I don't need to believe the stories that I was telling myself at that time. Mm-hmm. And what that means is I had a lot of emotional suppression, Brooke. So I didn't deal with the bullying. I didn't deal with the fact I used to self-harm at university, that I burnt myself out. Like, I didn't have the emotional, what I call it emotional maturity. Mm-hmm. So it's not a judgment on me or anybody else. It's just that I hadn't developed that ability to sit in and feel and process and let go emotion. So back in May 2018, I was like, why are there no podcasts talking about emotion and feelings? And, mm-hmm. you know, and back then, there probably was something out there, Brooke, but I just couldn't find it within my sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. So I just decided, why not? Why don't I put something on? And at that time, I'd literally just found Brené Brown's work, mm-hmm. at that time. So I read Braving the Wilderness, and it just really struck me to my core. And I was like, hang on, I've always been told that vulnerability is a weakness, as in like a computer vulnerability. I'd never thought about emotional or relational vulnerability as Brené does. So it just really was just this happy accident, bit of courage on my part to go, hang on, if it's not out there, why don't I just try and create the content? If I can't find it and I'm looking for it, mm-hmm. even if I can find one person that listens and they take that away, I may never hear from them, but I'm pretty sure that if I'm striving to find this content, it will help somebody else. So that was really the catalyst for why I started it. The reason for the name was actually quite intentional. Mm-hmm. So again, if you think about how I introduced as interpersonal catalyst, although I didn't have that language two and a bit years ago, the value part was intentionally trying to speak to some of those more difficult to reach people that would not just listen to vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so you put out a wonderful post a week or so ago about how do we reach the people that need to hear this message?
Yes.
Sort of almost by accident, that's what I did back with the podcast in May 2018 was go, I really believe that vulnerability is a strength. I believe that role modeling vulnerability invites others to try and show a bit more of their true self and dial up a little bit of their true self. However, how do we show that that's valuable? Hence the value comment. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's really an interplay between trying to create that safe space and conversation for other people to listen to the likes of you and I, and you kindly joined me quite recently on the podcast mm-hmm. on Value Through Vulnerability. And it's so really, it exists, Brooke, in summary, as a safe space for people to listen in to us having a conversation about topics that most people feel scared to talk about still. Yes. So it's really, I'm hoping that it gives people permission to sit in that conversation. And we may never hear about them. I don't hear much back from the podcast, but I just have an intuitive belief inside of me that we are giving value to the listener and that we will create over time value for businesses and society as this takes hold, because it will take hold at some point. I just don't think the world's fully ready for it yet, Brooke, to be honest.
Yeah. You just explained it so well. And I do believe, like you do, people don't always have to react or like or say a lot about what we put out there. But we want that to reach the people who need that message. And when it gets out there somewhere, even in when people share it or like it or tweet it, whatever, some people get really the important message that they had to hear because it's the right time for them. So we can't always, I believe, and I know you do the same, we can't always get too much connected to the results or when the results is going to happen. When is this going to be changing people? We just have to put it out there and see how the universe takes care of that. So I'm a big believer in that. And I agree with you. I have read, of course, Brené Brown and found her years ago too. And again, what she taught all of us about vulnerability is amazing. And that's why I think she's now imitating you and started her own podcast, right?
Yeah, she heard about us, Brooke. She heard about us.
Yeah, so she found out about you and says like, oh my God, Gary is doing vulnerability. I have to do it too. So yeah, but it's really important because that's what I, when I work with my one-to-one clients, especially like your journey, many people go through your journey. It's so common that we get burned out at some point or we get stuck or we got laid off. Something triggers us to look at ourselves differently and do the inner work, right? And during that time, we feel like it's only us. It feels like we are the strange one. We are the only one who got bullied or we are the only one who got stuck. And when we hear other people being vulnerable about that and telling us like you do all the time, about your own vulnerabilities, people feel like, oh my God, other people are feeling that too. I am not alone. This is being part of you, being human. This is the humanity. Because even in the culture that I grew up, there was not too much vulnerability. That was definitely weakness. So everybody, people like put a good face up there, but then people had so much going on in the background. And when I came here and started seeing really even celebrities sharing what they had to go through until they got to this point, lots of people I admire telling their real stories, raw stories, what they had to go through to come to this, then it was like a big awakening for me. Oh my God, these people were not only just special, just didn't have the best circumstances. They had to do a lot of work and failed so many times to get where they are. So showing our vulnerability and what day we had to go through to come to the point where it is unbelievably important because that's where the connection happens, really. And I remember one of my mentors said, like, you can never fall in love without being vulnerable. And it made me think at the time. I said, oh my God, really? But it's so true. Because you have to show who you are exactly with your weaknesses and strengths, and that's when other person feels you in like and understands you and gets bonded with you in a very special way. So anyways, yeah, we have a lot to talk about, but this was a good conversation because I really never got to ask you those important questions which stayed with me for a while. So now coming back to your experience, like I said at the beginning, you have a different view of the cultural transformation because I'm always the outsider. So I love to hear what an insider had to go through in a cultural transformation. So my first question is, I think, like, what first of all triggered this transformation? What happened? Did it happen just like by coincidence at some point? Or was there any events that lead up to the fact that you had to do something different?
Yeah, so what I will do, I'll put a little mini disclaimer out that I'm speaking with you, Brooke, as Gary and not as my organization.
Sure.
Because it hasn't been it's not a representation of the company. So it's purely me speaking. But yeah, in terms of what triggered it. So there were two, what I would say is the trigger was actually my development journey. Mm-hmm. So if we go back, so the main cultural transformation that we'll talk about this evening was between 2015 and 2018. Although some things have happened following on from that as well, the last 18 months. Mm-hmm. But pre-2015, I was still, what are we looking at now, 5 years? So it was basically end of 2013, early 2014, was when I was really looking at things and going, I've been with my work organization now 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. It's getting a little bit boring. You know, what can I do to try and make it different? So I actually looked to leave the organization at that time. And then credit to my line manager at the time, he said, look, what would it take for you to stay? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, to be honest, like, I like my job, but there's more to me. You're not getting the best out of me being just Gary's salesperson. I don't know what else rest of Gary looks like, but I'd really like to try and look at the people side, and I don't know much about it. And da, da, da. So long story short, Brooke, I ended up staying. And then I ended up getting trained up in learning and development, organizational design and development, became a chartered member of the CIPD, the Chartered Institute of Personal Development. And that's the equivalent of SHRM in the US.
Okay.
So it's an equivalent people body.
Sure.
So all of a sudden, after 3 years, so that was sort of between 2013 and 2016, that I became qualified in people. So as I was going through that journey, I had a word with my line manager at the time, who is still my line manager today, who's a great guy. He's very open-minded. Mm-hmm. But the trigger, to answer your question, was a combination of all of this insight and knowledge that I've been gaining through my training, through building a wider network outside of my organization. And that's something I'd really like your listeners to listen to. Mm-hmm. Building a network outside of your organization. Mm-hmm. Different roles, different people that don't look like you. Mm-hmm. Huge, made a huge difference to me personally. Mm-hmm. So that personal journey of Gary and all this experience and knowledge and growth, combined with my line manager going, okay, I can see what you're talking about. And actually, could we be better? So unlike change at times, Brooke, it wasn't a case that we were perceived to be broken or that there was a burning platform that needs to be put out by water. You know, it wasn't that traditional change.
Okay. You
know, highly profitable, making good money, good teams. There wasn't really any dysfunction, not in a major way.
Yes.
Within the team. So it's really what I would call, so I like to look at things, not just as a positive mindset, but really I believe that everything, people, not just process, can continuously improve, can continuously grow, can continuously get better. And that's really the journey that we embarked on, was to say, if you look at where we are right now as a team, we're making good money, we're growing, but we could be so much better. So that was really the trigger.
Yes, that's good, because sometimes that's what I say in real life too. Why do we wait until something horrible happens to make a change, right? And that happens to people in personal level too. Until we get to live something that's really hard for us to go through, then we are like, oh my God, there's so much more self-awareness. But I love the fact that there was no big trigger, but it still was the beginning of the change. Okay, so when you saw that the needs to happen and you got all these trainings and everything, before the transformation happened, did you have to go to the top level, to the top executives to get their buy-in? Or did you start it at the level that you were working already?
So this is, I smile quite widely when I have this conversation, Brooke, because no, we didn't seek top-down buy-in. And I think there was a slide share I saw by Accenture, one of the big four consultancies, yes, that came out a few years ago. And there's a myth around change management that it needs to be top down. Uh-huh. Now, the myth that they busted through their own work across something like 180 change projects.
Uh-huh.
Something like 80% of all effective change,
yes,
came from the middle out, not from the top down. 80% of effective change that works well does not come from the top.
Are you serious? I didn't see that statistic.
Because,
wow,
because if you think about it, the research I'm doing for my book at the moment also validates this. Quite often when it's top down, the people do not engage at a heart level. They only engage on a head level because they are told we are going through change. Here's a new system. Here's a new process. We're trying to sell the company. And people very rarely get bought into, at a heart level, the process of change. Whereas what we experienced is that, A, we were like, we know we need the change, so why are we going to go and ask somebody else, number one? Mm-hmm. And number two is that we had the experience, and we had the team, and we actually thought this through, Brooke. We said, if we run this experiment, it's not costing the company any money. It's with the people that we already have. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And if it works, it's great. And if it fails, it fails. Like, it's like a zero sum game.
Yeah.
But what actually happened in the end, and we can talk a bit more about this, is that we ended up increasing sales by 6 million over 3 years, gross margin by 1.5 million. And the, and we had the same people in post, so no change in personnel, and our market conditions were pretty similar. So if you looked at the numbers and the market situation, so it was a pretty much like for like comparison. And the only thing that changed is how we changed the culture and the purpose. And purpose was a key part of that change, was that transformation. And it was solely down to us running the experiment without seeking permission. And I would invite your listeners to think long and hard about whether they really need to seek permission before they run an experiment.
That is really interesting and very, very important to me, because in my own work, I have tried in different ways on how to help my clients. And it, to me, I mean, again, only my experience and some of the books that I read, like you did, everything showed in many cases that the consciousness level of the top leaders have changed in some point, like Bob Chapman, for example, right? If you read his book, as you did with all others, like he has an enlightening moment, which says like, okay, these are my people. These are like my family. I have to do something about it. But he didn't do it like command control, but he did get the, like the input of his people. So he did make his people part of the change. So it wasn't like, okay, from this point on, this is how we're going to lead this company. No. He didn't put it all on them, but he took all their input. So when they had a say in the process, in the change management, it worked beautifully. So, and it didn't, it doesn't mean it happens right overnight, right? It didn't happen overnight for them too. And in the same case, like Gary Ridge, again, he came through something triggered him to lead differently. And so in many, many of my cases, it's the same. If the executive level doesn't have the buy-in, it was very hard to make the change. So, and after a while, I saw examples like what you're mentioning today, that it does and sometimes happen from a different level, from the mid-level or from a department, from a group, which is not the case that many people hear. So that's why it was important to get your input on this, because you had a very different experience. But like you said, because you didn't need more money from the top, because you still work with the same people, because you didn't have to bring an insider to pay a lot, it was possible to do. Because in my cases, of course, there was money involved there. You have to have a more budget. There were days and resources that you have to put into this transformation that required basically the buy-in of the CFO, because he was going to give the money, or the CEO. So anyway, so I think it's a really brilliant, good conversation, a great example. That's why I didn't want to only hear it myself, but others to hear it from you. I think it's brilliant that it did not have to have the buy-in of the top people. So it's a great lesson for many of us to hear. And I have to check in that statistics that you mentioned from Accenture. So I'm going to look into that too. So what are the actual tasks or the practices that you build to make the transformation happen? And tied to that, maybe you can also answer, did it start with one group of people in one department and then you took it on to others? How did it all evolve?
Yeah, really good question, actually, Britt. So to give some extra context for you and your audience. So the change that I was directly involved with my line manager was 16 people. Mm-hmm. Across Europe. So it's a multinational team.
Okay.
And it's also a matrix team. So it's all decentralized, or it's a slightly matrix structure. So we're not all in the same. We have, if you think about it, you have profit and loss responsibility by country, mm-hmm. and we cut across as a team on a horizontal basis by market sector. So it's really a matrix structure, which actually makes culture change even more difficult, mm-hmm. to be honest, because you're having to play across different regions who all have their own local objectives. And the thing for us that was particularly interesting is that we found that if I go to 3 V's, actually, because this will help bring it to life a little bit. And I want to be very open and again, vulnerable. Like, this was not all done by design. It was very iterative. So we actually literally went step by, it's all about experimentation. So we thought, okay, what should we do? We think we could run our meetings better or more effectively. So if I bring that to life for you, meetings in the past in 2013, 2014 would have an international team of 16 people, death by PowerPoint. Every person going through by 1 hour, and it was totally irrelevant for the other 15 people. Because you'd be like, they'd be listening about numbers and customers, and although they cared about the other people in the team, it just didn't, the context was just completely lost. Because it's like, I don't, if I'm from France, I don't deal with Germany. So telling me about Germany for a whole hour doesn't make any sense. So it's a really simple little change. So instead of having 2 days of death by PowerPoint, we changed it and we developed things such as speed dating, for example, which meant 15 minutes international product manager with each region, half a day. Like, so we went from losing 2 days and people going, is it really adding value, to achieving within half a day, not just the same, but even better outcomes, because people were connected, they were engaged, they were part of the process. Back to that point about change, every single member of the team was part of that process. And that was the big shift. Whereas in the past, colleagues were basically told, you must present this by region. So there was no accountability, there was no heart involved in that process. So that's just one little example. Changing how we run meetings was very, very significant for us. Another one linked more back to the work that you do, Brooke, is around values. So we actually created a team set of values. So although the organization had values, then they were not particularly well, let's say, embedded. They're not particularly well lived and breathed by the organization on a local level. And our friend Jane Adsey-Grant taught me a while ago, she said, all culture is local. And it really provoked my thinking around, so even if you've got a big global corporation like Gary Vision WD-40 with these values on the wall in San Diego, like how someone in China translates those values locally will be in their local context. And I'd never thought about this before. So that, so these sorts of conversations led me with, we were thinking a little bit like that a few years ago. And then my line manager and I went, okay, so let's just create our own values. Like, what does that look like for us? You know, how do we want to behave together as a team of 16 people? So bringing that story up to date, we ended up developing our own set of values around curiosity, around excellence, around a whole range of other things. And that was really helpful for the team, because I mean, they then started to build a bit of an identity as a cross-functional team in Europe. And then that led us into Start With Why by Simon Sinek. And we literally built, and we still have our team culture based on Start With Why.
That's so, once that was implemented and everybody felt probably better about not only the meetings, maybe other stuff, that practices that you also had. So when did you start maybe having it even other, go into other departments, other groups? Like, when was the time that you started doing that?
Yes, that's really interesting. And that's still ongoing. So we, I would say we had this 2015 to 2018 experiment, which is what it was. And then we came together, my line manager and I went, okay, look at those, that big uplift in sales and margin, nothing else changed. Amazing. And then we took that to one of the board directors. So this is the point that we went to the senior leaders when we had something to show them. So instead of saying to them, can you please give us permission to do this? You know, whether there's investment in money or not, Brooke, my invitation to your listeners and your community is, think about what you can do with what you already have. And it doesn't mean don't bring in someone great like Brooke, or bring in someone external when the time's right, because that's always helpful, because you're seeing lots of different companies, lots of different people. We need that outside view sometimes. But my invitation to people is, don't stifle, don't block yourself from innovating and creating and coming up with new ideas because you think you need to ask for permission from somebody, because you don't need to ask permission. So what we did, we ran the experiment for 3 years. We had this great case study, this great story. And then of course, the rest of the business wanted more. Because which senior leader does not want more money and more margin from the same people? So that then extended into, so I've now ran, what, 15 workshops internally over the last 12 months. So what happened within our smaller part of our business, which was a 20-25 million turnover business, I've now been working with the senior leaders of the 400 million business group globally to replicate. Yes. And I think this is also important, not to copy paste, but to replicate parts that worked in the bigger context, but also let go the ones that don't work in the bigger context.
So
the key point was the actual, the energy. The energy was there and the appetite and the interest was there from the rest of the business because they saw there was this little disruptive internal experiment. I call it like an experimentation lab, Brooke.
Yes.
So we ran this little experimentation lab and we made it safe for other people to engage with the conversation.
Yeah, I know. No, it's a really wonderful story. One that we don't get to hear a lot, really. That's why it's important for people to see. And I love when you say, we sometimes do that individually when we want to change anything in our lives, right? We come up with like different excuses. Oh, I don't have the extra budget. I don't have the money. I don't have this. I'm too old, too young, whatever that is, right? But then we never sometimes even push ourselves to see what we can do with what we have now. And like you said, now people saw with the same people, same exact people, you didn't hire anybody. And you were able to tap into the potential of people in a very different and more innovative way, which many companies don't know how to do yet, unfortunately. And they're just killing the souls of the people from what I see, although people have a lot to offer. And you saw that, you brought it to your first line manager. Obviously, he's an open-minded person. And then it went from there. And that's the beautiful message. Even at the Human First event we did with Mike in San Diego, we had this conversation at the very end because many people believe, like I did at the beginning, if the top people do not buy it, you have no chance. No, then it's another limiting belief we have. So somebody like you who's like going through his individual self-development or whatever your own journey, and you see some kind of different awareness that you can bring in, you don't stop there and wait for leaders to do the same. Even it makes me even think of what we're going through with the COVID, the pandemic, like in the United States, especially. If you wait always the top person, the president to do stuff, you're going to wait for a long time. But then what do the mayors and the governors do? They take it all on their hands and do whatever they have with their own capabilities, with their teams, whatever they can do with what they can do instead of waiting, because waiting can be deadly right now. And in literal terms, it can also happen in companies too. If you wait for somebody else to take this and take the responsibility of making this transformation, you can really wait for a long time. And it might not kill people right away, but it kills their soul. It causes so much stress, you and I know. There's so many bad statistics. And work becomes the number one stress factor, which causes most of the physical illness we go through. So it's the same. So all that story and all the things that you went through is such a good lesson for all of us to really take from, because we don't see our potential normally as one person who can bring some change to the company. We feel like we are alone or we can't do anything on our own, which is not true. One person which has a higher consciousness level can do so much, which you obviously exemplified. So thank you for really sharing that. Really beautiful. So like during going through that transition, how important is to create the environment for people to feel really psychologically safe so that they can speak up, so that they can say, this is not good for me. They can say, this is not going right, even if you are trying to do the right thing. How did you do that? And I don't know your culture before this started, but did you already have that culture where people can speak up and say, or did you have to do something different as you started this transformation?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Brooke. So I would say the team's always been very good. It's always been very tight. But I would say there wasn't necessarily a curiosity challenging culture. So within our team of 16 people, so one of the values that we created, actually, I'll speak to that actually. Uh-huh. So the values that my line manager and I created, mm-hmm. we didn't co-create with the rest of the team, and that was a mistake. Mm-hmm. So he and I came up with the idea, back in 2014, 2015, we decided what we thought was right for the team. Mm-hmm. And we innocently but accidentally did not enroll the team into co-creating and buying into and challenging those values. Mm-hmm. So why I'm sharing that is that whilst they are still the values today and people are increasingly buying into them because they're more part of the journey now.
Yes.
In the early days, part of our issue was is that we lacked curiosity because people didn't actually buy into it. So people weren't as curious about their customer, or if something wasn't working properly, it was somebody else's job to sort out. And so it's these little cultural bits, which was one of the challenges for us, was actually how do we ensure that we co-create more intentionally? Yes. Yes. And that was one of our learnings. Like, we did not co-create as much in the early days as we should have done, Brooke. Yeah. Yeah. And that caused us some pain.
Yeah.
But if we fast forward to 18 months ago, we really got the understanding of co-creation, how important it was. Mm-hmm. And that's when we had a massive increase in a number of the unique practices, to use Gary Ridge's information, tribal language. So we actually have our own tribal language in this team around certain practices. Wow. That means which means something to us, but is there anybody else? It makes no sense.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, good, because I do the same. And like we were talking just 5 minutes ago, when you don't, and thanks for being vulnerable and telling us what were the mistakes that happened too. Yeah, I mean, when you co-create the purpose statement or the values, and people have a say on what the company should abide by, what should we care about when we make decisions for the company, they do have a better, they own it more and they embrace it more and much more faster than what you like give it to them. When you give it to them, it takes more time, although they believe the same values and they'll still be happy about it. When they have a say in it, it makes a huge difference. That's why when I do and work with companies, I never want only the executive team to come up with the purpose statement. We want people to pitch in, but at the same time, it also makes me think and remember some of those days that I am practicing this. People are also skeptical if they haven't been asked their opinion before. So this time they want this to stick, but they also are very hesitant. So you have to give them the time to trust the executive team and everybody who's coming up with the values and purpose, that this is going to be an ongoing thing that we want to align with. It's not only a nice thing to have, and we just don't ask you your opinion just to look nice right now. So it takes them time to trust the process and to see over and over and over and again that decisions are made based on that from that point on. At first, what I see and observe is they are skeptical, even if they're asked their opinions, because if the culture was very different beforehand, they will wait and see, and they have every right to be skeptical and hesitant to believe in it. So that's a big part of that too.
Yeah, I love that, Brooke. I'd love just to add, because I'm conscious, I went on a bit of a waver to the side of your question around psychological safety. So just to come back to that specifically, the employee voice part for us has been critical in creating that safety. It's a practice, back to your word, you know, the environment can be made safe quite. So I do that with a lot of my workshops in terms of getting people's consensus to agree to leave the job titles outside for the next 3 hours or the next 2 hours, or to leave your PhD or your whatever ego you have. Let's agree to leave it outside, and then we come together, and that tends to work quite well. But the employee voice part for us has been very, very significant. And what we mean by that is the actual invitation. Like, and your point is so important, Brooke, the time. Like, actually intentionally creating space for people to be heard and to be seen has been the number one factor that's built that psychologically safe environment. Because if we're continually running at 100 miles an hour, you can say it's safe, but people don't feel it's safe. And I think it's this, again, it's the whole head-heart disconnect, which I think you and I are very passionate about fixing.
Yes.
But that's definitely been where it works well, is where we've slowed down, taken our time, given everybody the chance to be heard and to be seen.
Yeah.
And of course, I call it slow down to speed up. Like, And if you look at the current situation we're all dealing with, I had a conversation the other day, Brooke, and someone said, now I'm running at 30 to 40 miles per hour and not at 90 miles per hour.
Yeah.
I'm seeing and sensing so much more than I did 5 weeks ago.
I agree. Yeah. For those who are paying attention, there's so many lessons to take out of these days. That definitely is. Yeah, I agree. And slowing down. That's why I think a lot of resistance that I see in companies or who are going through this cultural change, they know this is going to take time. It doesn't happen overnight. You're telling me the experiment that you took from 2015 to 2018, it takes years, right? So they feel like it's going to affect their business. They don't want to slow down. They don't want to take the time to get into these meetings where they come up with their purpose and values. But in the long term, it helps the company in so many ways, including the numbers, as you mentioned, which they care about most, right? Every company is there to make profit, and there's no judgment about that, of course. But then we should do it in different ways than we were taught, because it does pay off at the very end. Because I always say, like, we didn't know about human psychology like as much as we do today, like 20, 30 years ago. Now we know people really care about having meaning at work. They're not there only for the paycheck. They want to create relationships with their peers, their colleagues. That makes them feel more fulfilled. So when you tap into that energy, people give more just automatically. And if you're only there for the paycheck and you only do the minimum just to get away with it, I mean, nobody's benefiting from that, including the people who do get the paycheck at the end of the month. You're not getting anything out of that. So I love what you used in one of your articles, return on humanity instead of ROI. That's what it all boils down to. I love that. Return on humanity, which made me think, actually, one of the people and one of my mentors that I met has even had this book called ROPI, return on your people investment.
Oh, nice.
Nice, isn't that nice? So it made me think of that too. So return on humanity, return on your people investment is so much bigger than the ROI, which I was sick and tired of when I was working for the corporate, really. Two words that I hated after being in corporate for such a long time. ROI, definitely. The second one was quarterly results. I mean, it's so myopic, it's so like short-minded and short-term. And then at the end of the day, that's why they even look at the churn of the biggest Fortune 500 companies. Of course, the criteria to be a Fortune 500 doesn't even align with what you and I are talking about. But even if we were to look at them as the best companies in the world, they change so much. Why? Because in the short term, it looks great. They make a lot of money. In the long term, especially with so much consciousness level and the consciousness level that this next generation is bringing forth, it's so hard to survive. So, which is a good thing. And with everything that this virus is disrupting, if we were to see it, I mean, there's so many opportunities there. I just published an article on LinkedIn just before I met you here online, actually. I mentioned only four of them, but there's so much more to get away and to get lessons out of what this is trying to teach us. But we'll see what happens. We'll watch as we go.
And it's a brilliant article. I saw it before we came on. I think you've touched on some of the real significant opportunities. And again, what you've pointed to for me, Brooke, is not particularly expensive from a monetary point of view. Exactly. It's more a mindset point of view. Huh?
Yes. And exactly what you're saying, right? You didn't have a big budget. You didn't have anything so sophisticated and everything. So, you're going to talk with my friend, Doug Kirkpatrick, too. When I look at the principles of self-management, we're not putting big charts and everything out there. Even when I did my webinar, I was even telling people at the very beginning, don't expect those very cumbersome, wonderful charts, which are so complicated. And that makes us feel like, oh, we're so important. We have this amazing formula to give to you. No, you did it by experimenting, little stuff, right? How do we change the meetings? How do we change maybe how we hire people? How do we change how we do the training to people so that it sticks. It's not only there. So little things that we learn can be experimented and it works with the same people you have. So it doesn't have to be cumbersome like we make it to be. And again, in these times, the bureaucracy that we have created, the layers and layers of management is causing us so much harm because it takes us such a long time to make good decisions. And it's not good for us. And even before this happened, we were talking about it because we couldn't keep up with the change in the world. We couldn't keep up with the change in technology because we have so much bureaucracy that we created as human beings. But all of this is teaching us so much about all of that. Anyways, yeah, I'm getting out of our topic, but I think everything is related too, right?
Absolutely.
So during this journey, one of the last few questions that I want to ask you, what did you learn something about yourself going through the journey? I know that you had your individual journey, which even triggered some of this journey at work, but doing this work and experimenting everything, did it make any change in you as well?
Yeah, I think to be honest, one of the bigger things for me, Brooke, was actually, I think about it from the point of view of my presence within the business. So I used to be one of those people within the business, call it the middle level. I wasn't anti senior leaders, but I just felt they always blocked people. Like my default belief was like, I was almost like a little bit anarchist, like, come on, we can try and we can do this. We don't need to go and seek permission. And what I've actually developed is a much deeper empathy for those that work at the top of an organization when they're dealing with markets and governance. And, you know, it's a completely different world that I would not actually enjoy being part of.
Yeah.
It's a completely different skill set and one that I did not understand.
Uh-huh.
So I have no regrets at all for what we did and how we did it. I believe it is absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's being used in other parts of the business now is testament to that. But I think what I've learned myself is to come from a place of much deeper empathy, regardless of who you're dealing with, and really try, and I'm still practicing this myself. Yeah. I'm not perfect at all, but really trying to see, no matter who they are and what they're doing, from a point of equal humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And I've not always done that, Brooke, to be honest.
Yeah. And I think like going through our journey is the most important part. That's why it doesn't happen before we do our inner work, because you see how many things come from your background, how many layers of stuff that we have to deal with. So when you meet someone at work or a colleague that's stuck or is not functioning really well or productively, they have their own journey to take on it as well. That's why there's nothing wrong with them. It's just like we are all in different stages of life. We're all in different stages of self-awareness. So they're not trying to block anyone. Nobody's trying to do that intentionally, is how I feel at least. It's just like in their subconscious yet. And until you become conscious of what is blocking you, your limiting beliefs, you can't overcome them. So whenever we feel frustrated with someone, at least that's what I'm trying to do. I'm saying, okay, they have their own thing that's going on and they're not maybe self-aware yet. So it's not me for me to judge them. I should have empathy and compassion for that person because there's going to be a time for them to figure out what they need to do to move forward, not to block themselves. But yeah, I mean, so empathy, I totally get where that will come from during the journey at work and in your personal life too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's funny. We've mentioned her already, Brooke, Brené Brown, but I remember, I think it was in Dare to Lead, uh-huh. one of her later books.
Uh-huh.
This really struck me really, really to my core. She says, people are always doing the best they can in the moment with the information that they have at that time.
True.
And it's like really profound. Profound.
Yeah. And I don't know if I heard it from her, but I've heard it many, many times, but it's so true because it's so much easier to blame others, including when we go back to our past, it's our parents or whatever. But again, if you remember that they were doing the best with what they had at the moment, That's what they, everybody can do, right? And we can't force anybody to make a huge change without their willingness to do so. So you just learn that over time, I think, as we get more, as we understand more human psychology. I think that's the bottom line. But yeah. So anything that through that journey that you went through at work that I didn't ask, which you want people to know, anything that people should get, and you did mention some of them already, like that they don't have to wait for getting permission. They don't have to have the buy-in. So those are very important lessons to take from it and see their own potential, see that they can start a big change, even if it's like little steps. Is there anything else that you want them to hear from what you had gone through?
I would say, if I may offer two invitations, Brooke. So one directly linked to your question is, wherever you work, if you're working in a corporate or even if you're consulting as you do to organizations, understand what the three or four key metrics are that matter to the senior leadership team.
Yes.
So one organization, it might be gross profit, net profit, return on sales, EBITDA. But for another organization, it might be, you know, M&A activity. It might be they want to increase by 25% in, you know, Africa. You know, understand the metrics that matter to the organization that you're working with or that you work for.
Yeah.
And I think, because if you can't communicate with the senior leaders in their language, it's very difficult to progress things. So I think that's one thing I would offer. The other thing more generally, if I may, Brooke, is, so I'm summarizing it as the three V's, and this really came to me in the moment before we spoke today. Uh-huh. If you're looking to try and be the best version of you personally, but also help others be the same in a work context, think about voice, think about values, and think about vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So how do you ensure that your voice and others is heard and that people are seen? You know, do you know what your values are and why they matter to you? And do you know why the people around you have got what values they've got? And then practice being vulnerable. Practice telling people something about you that maybe they don't know. And it doesn't have to be warts and all as you and I talk, but it might just be a little bit of, you know, I don't know that answer. Or actually, I fell out with a friend the other day and I don't know how to deal with that. You know, just show you're human.
Yes.
Like the voice, values, and vulnerability. And I think if you can practice those three, change becomes a whole lot easier.
Yes, I love that. And I'm waiting for your article or podcast about the three V's. Yes. That's brilliant. And I love the two, both of the invitations that you had. And it's so true to meet companies where they are, or our co-workers, our leaders. I mean, speak their language. That's why it's so key, like you said, what do they care about? Because even if we know what they should be doing, we can't go in there and tell them that this is what you need to do, because they're not gonna really listen to you until you can show them this is gonna change the what they care about, like whatever that is, the bottom line or the KPIs, whatever they're working on. So it's a very good point. And I think I have heard that from Edgar Schein. I don't know if you know him. Years ago in a big conference in San Francisco, he said, like, that's one of the mistakes that many consultants do. We feel like we know it and we know the solution to it. But then we're there, like, almost like with ego driven to tell them what to do. Although what we want to tell them is not to tell what to do to their people. So how does that go along, right? We can't do what we preach is what we need to do. So I totally agree with that. So that's brilliant and really important that you share that. Like I said, we don't get to hear a lot of case studies from inside of the companies. We always hear what the consultants were able to do. And I do hear what you say when you say, like, it's sometimes really good to have fresh eyes coming to a company, because some people are really in the box. They don't get to really see it in any different way because they're biased by a certain point until somebody inside gets to really get to be awakened and understand that it can be done internally. But it's really important that we see our power when we believe in something. It's important that we go with it. And that's why the three V's are important. We have to voice what we believe is right. And at the end, if nobody is listening, if it can't be done, that's what I did. I had to leave my job, right? It didn't work. And I did say it in every level. to the HR managers, to the general managers and everything, but it did not work. So what do you do then? You say, okay, goodbye. I want to make that change somewhere else, right? But we should give it a try and not give up so fast, not because we can't get the buy-in. That's one lesson I learned from you and some from others too. And also the voice of people. What do we do as consultants? We go and talk to the people of the company. They always have the answers. Many, many of the answers are there with them. And then the potential, the energy to work harder and to get engaged and put their heart and soul is with them too. So what it was again, return on humanity is really important. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Brooke. And I think if I may just make one final comment, like that return on humanity comment, if you're listening, I can't give you a formula. Uh-huh. I can't give you a model. Like, you've just got to trust that leading through your people is going to give you better results. And we've got Raj Sisodia, we've got Barry, you know, there's a lot of big names that have proved it. And now we've proved it as well. So like, just trust treating your people with humanity will deliver better results, because it will. Yes.
And to me, it really boils down to really our left, right brain, if we can say it in that distinction. We always try to find the analytical steps and everything from A to Z to start this off, because it's left brain trying to analyze and find the right solutions. But we should make use of more of our hearts or our right brain, which is more intuitive, which knows what to do, what is really the right thing to do. And that guides us. And I think in one of your podcasts, actually, was it Visley or the, I don't know the actual name, the mortgage company from Netherlands.
Tom van der Lubbe from Visi. Yeah.
Yes. So what he said was brilliant. You don't need a lot of documents, processes. He says that we have one thing, one principle: treat others as you would be wanted to be treated yourself. That's it. Sometimes it's that simple. We have to get out of those complex charts, complex steps and processes to make this up. It is so much easier. That's why I love that you mentioned several times when you were explaining the transverbs that you were just experimenting. And the little things like how to make these meetings more effective, little things like that makes a huge difference in the end, right? So,
Absolutely.
Thank you. I'm so glad we had this conversation. So I know some people would love to reach out to you and maybe ask more questions or understand and read your stuff, listen to your podcast, where they can reach you, Gary.
Thank you very much, Brooke. This has been fun. So you can find me, and thank you if you've joined us this far. So you can find me on Twitter at Gary IP Catalyst. That's GARRY IP Catalyst, all one word. On LinkedIn, Gary Interpersonal Catalyst, all one word. And my email is GaryTurner0@hotmail.com, which is GARRY Turner0, all one word, @hotmail.com.
Okay. And when we make this public and share this, we'll put that in the description and the information to get back to you too. So, but thank you, my friend. It was really great. I learned so much on this call, which I plan to do for a long time. So I'm glad we had that chat with you, that we should do this together. And I'm glad we did it today together.
Me too. And thank you very much for creating the space as well. As you say, it's not something I've spoken publicly with other people about that much. Yeah. And I think you're right. We need more good positive stories of human change. So
yes. And like you said, we can't really be tied to the results of this. We'll just put it out there. Whoever needs to see and hear this is going to see it and watch it and listen to it. And you don't know, even if maybe 10 years from now, somebody can watch it, because it's going to be alive somewhere. And you might be touching somebody to do like, okay, why am I waiting for somebody else? Maybe I can be the change that I want to see in my company. So why not, right? So it's really important. So thank you for being who you are and all the work that you do out there and sharing all the good stuff of other people that you have on your podcast and all the good articles that you write. I mean, I can't list everything you do. Like I said, you have 48 hours in a day. I only have 24. So I'm going to stop there.
Thank you, Brooke.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Really hoping that you enjoyed that exploration on the Value Through Vulnerability podcast. You can find out much more about Hexo Change at hexochangenow.com. That's hexochangenow, one word, .com. You can subscribe to a weekly newsletter at that website, which includes information about live stream conversations, further service offerings, blogs, but also our in-person events, of which we have multiple each year. So I really hope that you'll join us. Do connect with me, Gary Turner, on LinkedIn, and I really hope to hear from you soon.